1984, Larry Hickman interviewing Margaret Blair. Toward the end of your term at Smith, you were undergoing some emotional stress and getting the most support from your house mothers.
Well, that was really not toward the end. That was in the middle, I would say. And I felt I was going crazy, not only because I didn't sleep for 2 weeks, but because the house mother thought that the reason I didn't sleep must be that I was pregnant. And here I had never allowed a boy to kiss me. And she would, for instance, she was at dinner time dishing out the food. She would say to me, "Now, do you think you should have that in your condition?" She also said she had little birdies watching me, so she knew in the morning if I didn't come down for breakfast early, she figured I was having morning sickness. And anyway, that. However, I began sleeping after I decided that it was better to go insane than to be conscious of all the, all the injustices in the world, all the things that I couldn't figure out myself. I said, well, it's really much better to be insane. So beginning then, I began to sleep again without any help from the house mother or anybody else. Anyway, I really didn't care for any of my courses there or any of my teachers. And at the end of the, when I left, I found out that I had had this globus hystericus. That summer, I spent in Yellowstone Park as a pillow puncher. That's a fancy name for May, because I had the job of making beds in the cabins in the morning, cleaning out the cabins. We'd be finished at 11 o'clock. They hired all college students for this in the lodges in Yellowstone. And two of my sisters had already worked on, three of them in fact, all three. So there I met my cousin, Maud Harriet, whose father was then governor. She was a waitress at Old Faithful, Nebraska. She was a waitress, and she had much longer hours than I had. At 11 o'clock we were finished, and so we would meet people and be driven around to the different parts of Yellowstone Park, and we really had quite a gay time. And there were a lot of young men there who were called pack rats. They were the ones that a porter was called a pack rat. Uh-huh. And the waitresses were called heavers. They had all these crazy names. Anyway, it was, I went out a lot that summer, and I guess by the end of the summer I had been kissed. Anyway, then that fall, my cousin, Maud Harriet, decided to come back to the University of Washington with me. So we hitchhiked from the Yellowstone Park to Spokane.
Is that the first time you'd ever
hitchhiked? Yes. You weren't afraid? No, I'm not really afraid of anything. But we did learn that the very first ride we took was really in the park from one park to another. And it was two middle-aged men, and they really, it was a big mistake, but we were able to get out when we came into a another of the areas in the park. We had put them off and told them, well, at least wait till we get to so-and-so, you know, so we jumped out and they called us cheats, and from then on we didn't take a ride with anybody unless it was a family or a couple at least. We didn't have any trouble after that. And in Spokane, my mother wasn't shocked about it. My father, in fact, she spread the news around, so they put it in the paper there, which embarrassed my cousin because
about our hitchhiking.
Well, not about the encounter. We didn't even tell it.
Oh, I see.
No, just about the hitchhiking. That was enough to shock most of the people in Spokane. Anyway, so she went to Seattle with me, and we took an apartment. She and I and my sister Mary, who had been teaching school and couldn't keep any discipline, so she decided to take a library course. and an old friend of hers from Spokane, Eva. The four of us took an apartment together, and that's when I decided to resign from the high and mighty Kappas, and I sent them a letter telling them that I just didn't want any association with such a snobbish organization, and to please, I would like to return my pin and get my money back from the pin and not have any connections. Well, they thought I was a little bit crazy because nobody ever resigns from the campus. So they first sent an alum that was a Kappa alum who was a psychiatrist. And she interviewed me. And then they sent a group of four, tried to convince me. You see, I tried to explain that they...
In Spokane,
this was. This is in Seattle.
That's in Seattle, sorry.
Seattle, yes.
Where the university is.
Yes, where the university is. And I tried to explain to her that the Catholics tried to make everybody according to the same mold. We were supposed to be perfect mentally, morally, physically, and emotionally, I suppose. Yeah. I don't even know what the four corners were. But they tried to convince me that they needed people that didn't like this, you know, and so forth. But I told them I wasn't any martyr, and I just didn't care for most of the people in the sorority. And I realized they didn't want to send an announcement to Pan Hellenic saying that anybody had resigned from their precious sorority, so that it would be all right with me if they wanted to wait until June, when school was out, and send the notice around. I just wanted to be relieved of having any connection with them immediately. So they agreed to that. So that was that. And
so then you enrolled.
Then I enrolled, and I think it was that year I decided to major in psychology, because the few courses I'd had in psychology seemed to be a little more connected with reality than anything else I studied. And
your interview with the psychiatrist.
And also, what was worrying me, I figured I had to major in something where I could get a job. I didn't want to be a school teacher. Two of my sisters had been, in fact three, I guess. None of them were crazy about it. And I had always sort of worried about how I was going to make a living. We were brought up with the idea, all of us in the family was told that when we were 21, we were on our own, whether we were in college or where. So I was sort of worried about how I was going to make a living. I remember when I was real young, I noted that you could buy stale bread.
Really? Even as a child?
Yes. Well, as a child, you see, we used to have tramps, they were called, coming to the back door all the time, wanting to mow the lawn, you know, to get lunch. And my family, my mother always invited them in and gave them dinner in the kitchen, or lunch or whatever it was. And it used to worry me that there were people that couldn't get jobs. There was also a poor family that lived a couple of blocks away in a great big old house that was sort of falling down, and I couldn't get over that either. Anyway, I had decided that maybe I could get a job if I had those little letters after my name, but I really didn't feel I was learning anything in college, in any of the colleges I went to. But I went through Washington. I guess I took some examination to get into Stanford. I decided I'd graduate there because Thurman was the head of the psychology department, and he's the one that developed the Stanford Binet test. So I went to Stanford.
Well, first of all, how many years did you spend in Seattle at the University of Washington?
Well, I spent that year. Well, I spent the first year. Oh, didn't I tell you that?
Yes, the first year.
I spent the first year, and then to Smith, and then back to Washington, and then to Stanford.
I see.
And I didn't have any, I can't think of anything I learned at Stanford either. in my courses.
Well, back just for a minute to the university.
Okay.
Yeah. Were you influenced by any of your professors there at that time, even though you didn't?
I had one good psychology professor, but frankly, I wasn't very much impressed by any of my professors.
Did you have any social life there?
Oh, yes, we had a lot of social life, especially when we were in the apartment, because we could run around and stay out as late as we wanted, and that's where I was brought up in a prohibitionist family, and it was that year, I think, that I had my first taste of liquor, and the first happened to be absinthe. And that was during prohibition, but anyway. No, the social life was fine there. And the college, the courses I really enjoyed more than anything at Smith. When I got to Stanford, it seemed about the same. Well, it wasn't quite as bad as Smith because there were both men and women. And of course, I was impressed then because so many of the students were wealthy and had cars.
Now, this is at Stanford?
This is Stanford. Now I'm in Stanford and in Robley Hall. In fact, I got in trouble there with the sororities again because I was going around with a girl from Spokane and called in by Pan-Hellenic, said that it was considered rushing if I talked to any student that had been there the year before, you know. So ridiculous. I told them they didn't have to worry about me, that I had been in a sorority. And I think I told them I was kicked out because I figured they probably wouldn't believe I resigned. And they didn't have to worry about that. But it was the same old story there with sororities. So anyway, I lived in Robley Hall.
Oh, you did live in
Robley Hall? Yes. Yes. This was a women's.
Yeah.
At that time, only, I think it was 1/10 of the student body were women. Now I believe, you know, it's happening. You know, there's no discrimination. There it was very few women were allowed. It might have been a third. It was either a third or a tenth. I don't remember. So I graduated.
Well, you made, you had no really, weren't influenced by any of the professors there either. I mean,
no.
At Stanford.
No, I did find out that I was also majoring in psychology. Because I wondered why everybody seemed a little different than me. I thought I was a little crazy, but I found that most of the people that majored in psychology were the same.
You always thought you were different from other people, or in the university in any case.
Well, yes. No, at all these colleges, I never was as social as the others. I guess I was sort of backward socially. And
did you date at all?
Oh, yes, I dated both. I dated at all the places, all the colleges. But, you know, I didn't ever feel I was in love.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I did. In the University of Washington, I really sort of felt I was in love with somebody. But I figured he was too conservative that we'd never get along. So that was the end. But I really... Yes, that was the only one that I took seriously at all. And so I got my little degree.
What was the graduation exercise?
Oh, I didn't stay for the graduation. I got my diploma. Maybe it was mailed to me. Anyway, I got my diploma and I went home before the exercise. Because frankly, I was never influenced by ceremonies. I guess that's one religion. I never felt religion much, and I wasn't impressed by ceremonies. No, no. So, now what do you want?
Well, you have your diploma now. Did you go back home then for that summer?
Oh, yes, I went back home.
You worked at this?
And I worked at the Spokane Crevice.
The same job?
For not too long, because I was going to go to New York to look for a job and earn my living now that I was graduated. So I talked my mother into going with me and taking a trip on a ship. I think it was the SS Pennsylvania. Anyway, there was a line that went around through the canal, and we stopped at Panama, and we stopped at Cuba, and we went on to New York.
Do you have any memories of Cuba?
Yes, I do. I remember going into the beer garden, and of course there were a lot of young people on the boat, and as soon as we got out 16 miles or whatever was the limit for prohibition, the liquor came out, and of course my mother didn't dream that I ever took a drop to drink, but a few times I could barely walk down the steps with her to dinner, but she didn't ever know, say a thing, except she did a couple of times say that she saw me in the card room drinking lemonade when I was in the bar having a drink with some of the young people there. And I had a couple of young men that I ran around with. I was very impressed in Panama because we went around on one of these little horse and buggy, and the air in the middle of the night was just so balmy and beautiful. I guess that's why I like Mexico and the tropics, because
The contrast with
it just seemed wonderful.
How long were you in Cuba?
We were just a day and a night. In fact, I think we got back to the ship about 5 in the morning, just before it was going to had to leave. So when I got to New York, I lived with my sister Polly.
What was she doing?
She, at that time, I think she was probably working for Harper's Bazaar. When I was in college, she had been working for Norman Bell Geddes. He's a decorator, isn't he? Anyway, she was doing some artwork. And he was a little strange because he was always playing war games. He had little models and things. Isn't that crazy? Also, when I would visit her vacations when I was at Smith, she was having an affair with one of the professors at Smith, and I used to take the messages back and forth. And she wanted this professor to find some young man and teach me the facts of life, but I really wasn't interested in finding out that way, too. Anyway, while I was there then, living with her, we had an apartment, and we would, in the summertime, when it gets awfully hot, we would go away weekends to Old Greenwich. We had an apartment.
You had two apartments?
Yeah, well,
the family had one.
No, it was she, maybe with some other friend. I don't remember that. But when I arrived with my mother, the weekends we would go out to Old Greenwich, I think it was. Maybe it was Mamaroneck the first year. And that's when I spiked my mother's drink once, and she came back on the train with me to New York and said that was the best lemonade she had ever had. I didn't tell her at the time, but I did years later, but she wouldn't believe me that I would do that.
She wasn't amused?
No, she just refused to believe it. Anyway, then I guess we got back, that must have been August and September that I arrived in New York, and as soon as the hot weather was over, then I started looking for a job, seriously. I'd look just as if I had a job. I'd go from place to place, 9 o'clock till 5 o'clock every day, following the newspapers, going to agencies. This was 1931, the fall of 1931. Well, it was so difficult, and you have all sorts of experiences because a lot of places want to get free work out of you.
Would they ask you to demonstrate
Yes, they would have maybe 15 people in there typing things that would, supposedly it was just to see if we were good enough to have the job. We were doing work for
them. We were doing the work, yeah.
We'd do that, and well, had all sorts of experiences. Finally, I took a job where I was getting paid, but there were about a dozen of us being tried out to be the manager, I guess supervisor was the title, of the Educational Records Bureau. That was connected with Columbia University. It was run by the wife of one of the professors there, Ben Wood. And they were experimenting with the Hollerith machine. This all developed later into computers.
It was IBM.
IBM and Hollerith. What they did, you see, the Educational Records Bureau had testing programs for private schools all over the country, both in achievement tests and intelligence tests. And then the same tests were given by the same schools for the same grades. Then we would hire temporary workers to score the tests. And these temporary workers were mostly students from Columbia and Barnard.
Yeah.
And they were getting 50 cents an hour. And I was supervising all the scoring and then making charts and graphs afterwards. And we published a booklet comparing the different schools and gave each school a record of how their students stood in relation to the other schools. I also did a few problem children from some of the schools in New York. I would give them the Stanford Brunet test. And
any time during this time, did you ever have your own IQ estimated?
I took the Stanford Brunet test myself when I was in grade school in about the third grade. And I came out all right. It was 140 something.
Yeah, above average.
Yeah.
Way above average.
Yeah. Well, I think the line there was, I think they call that genius, but that's ridiculous. Anyway.
I know, I haven't seen it.
Anyway, at that, the hours were very long during the rush periods. This would last for some months. And you didn't get any overtime pay, and I'd just be exhausted, and my legs would turn black and blue from bumping into all these tables where all rushing around all day. Anyway, I was working there when I got married. Well, I met this man that I told you about on my way to Smith the first year. Had shown me around Chicago. Came to New York to live, and he looked me up. And we lived together for quite some time before I decided to get married, because his mother was always coming to visit us, and it was such a problem trying to hide my clothes and all this business. It was ridiculous. So I just got paid for convenience. And but I did get a little disgusted. I used to look at him and think, oh my goodness, I really wouldn't want any children like him, because he was very nice looking and polite and all this. He had graduated from Yale, and
what was his profession?
Well, he was ethyl gasoline. I don't know. He was a statistician.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, he was some relative of President Cleveland. And he was from a society group in Chicago, and I never, did like society people very much. People that, anyway, what disgusted me was that he would agree. We would be discussing something and arguing with friends about something, and he would be agreeing with them, and maybe 10 minutes later, we would be talking to somebody else about the same thing, and if their opinion was opposite, he'd agree with them. He didn't seem to have a mind of his own. And I just decided that was terrible. And so,
how long were you married?
We were married 2 years. What happened was that my brother John came to town. I had decided he was a little in the clouds because he would write a letter and sign it, Comrade John. I thought, oh, he's really a nothing. But when he came, he was able to answer questions that had bothered me for years. He was the first person that really had answers. So he got me to go to the workers' school and I influenced my sister Mary to go, and her husband went as a chaperone, and all of us, we had a marvelous teacher at the school.
What was this? I mean, what did the school consist of? What were the courses? What did you do?
Well, the courses were all about what socialism was, and communism. And I had the best teacher, better than any teacher I had in any of the colleges I was in. I mean, he was really marvelous. He had a good sense of humor, and he made things so clear, and, well, I remember his name was Martin. I never heard of him since, but everybody that had him thought he was a wonderful teacher. So, this didn't please my husband very much, because he was on the other side of the fence, you know.
Were you bringing literature home?
Yes, I was bringing books home, and I was trying to convince him of what was the wrong, why the United States was having a depression. I could understand it, and he would rush to get some of his books from Yale and economics, and he couldn't answer any of these questions. And I couldn't. That drove him to drink more. He always did drink some, but he began drinking more, and so some nights he wouldn't come home. When he did, he would throw my books out the window. We lived way up above the George Washington Bridge, so it was a long way for the books to go down. And so one weekend, when he went up to a Harvard-Yale football game, I just moved out with half the furniture into Greenwich Village, and that was that.
You hadn't threatened us at all, or told him that you thought you might?
No, I don't think I did, but I guess I left a note saying that I might even have left, well, my sister Mary and Bill was quite near us up there, and so did my sister Polly, I believe. So you knew.
And did they know? They know you were going to leave, or you told them immediately after?
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know whether I told anybody. I just know. I remember I went looking for. It didn't take long to find an apartment, because after all, during the depression,
there were a lot of
apartments.
Yeah.
And so I found one in Greenwich Village, quite near the waterfront. And
were you active on the waterfront politically?
Well, yes. As soon as I moved out, I joined the CP, and so they put me in the waterfront section because I just lived a block from there. And I was made organizer of the group. It was called a unit at that time. The unit quite soon, because I was quite conscientious about going down to the docks. We go down early in the morning, when the longshoremen would form a semicircle and shape up. There's a lot of favoritism, you see, and the boss would point his finger at different ones that he knew, and
those are the ones who would get jobs.
They would get the jobs, and the others wouldn't get any jobs. And some of them, there were blacks that had even walked all the way down from Harlem, which was 4 or 5 miles, you know. And
this is what time in the morning was
about? Well, this was about 7 o'clock in the morning. I think the shape up was at 7, maybe it was at 7:30, but we were down there early with literature and talking to the longshoremen. And when we made a connection, we would get their name and address, and then we would take one of the men with us to visit them at night, you see. And that was a gangster-controlled union. You know, you've heard of J.P. Ryan, Joseph P. Ryan. He was the head of the ILA. It was one of the gangster unions. And
when you say gangster union, what do you mean?
Well, there was a big loading racket that all the consumers in New York pay for. It's probably still going on. That for every pound or kilo or ton, however they measured it, paid a certain amount of money to get unloaded.
Right.
This is extra. This is
a
tribute. And so they just came to millions and millions of dollars. And
were the workers aware of this?
There was a certain group of workers that did the particular this particular work that had the grass connected with it. They did, and quite a few of the workers were parolees from the penitentiary. Those were the ones that the gangsters hired, the gangsters in the union hired. And so it was, anyway, we put out a paper. These longshoremen that we would meet would write letters about the conditions, and we'd call this was the hook. But it was all just letters from the longshoremen and conditions there. And they would go to union meetings. Of course, they were mostly afraid to get up on the union floor and say much because they knew
who was involved.
Yeah. And in fact, if you paid enough money, you could belong to the union, you know, without doing any work there. In fact, later on, the person who was in charge of this work on the waterfront, he got in the union, and he used to play tennis with...